When you raise the question of adaptation, probably the great disappointment of the Hobbit films as a whole, they are not a faithful adaptation. Though that doesn't necessarily make them automatically bad films.
You're listening to All About Jack, C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com, and this is a special edition, part two of a discussion about the Hobbit movies, comparing them with the books. I have again with me Dr. Charlie Starr, Dr. Crystal Hurd, and Brenton Dickinson. Let me go ahead and tell you a little bit about each of them as I welcome them officially onto the show. Dr. Charlie Starr is the author of two recent books, one more recent than the other. It's a sci-fi story he'll be telling us about at the end. It's called The Heart of Light. The other one is actually came out a few years ago. It's simply called Light and explores a essay by C.S. Lewis that has some mystery surrounding it. Welcome back to All About Jack, Charlie.
Thanks, William. I'm happy to be here.
Dr. Crystal Hurd has done a variety of things. She has a great website, and she is also known especially for her discussion of Lewis and women on her blog. And then we did a mini-series with her on All About Jack. And she, not that long ago, released a book entitled 30 Days with C.S. Lewis, A Women's Devotional. Thanks for joining us again, Crystal.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And then Brenton Dickinson is with us again, and he has a great website called A Pilgrim in Narnia. Thanks for joining me again, Brenton.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Well, now, we covered quite a bit of ground, and we encourage people to listen to some of the background opinions, which you can repeat to some extent here as you comment about some different factors. One of the things we were doing at the end of the first program was looking at a few of the many that people could probably pick apart, saying, hey, why was this change? Why was that change? Or you know, this modification, or even a totally new character introduced. Well, let's start off with this. How do you feel about Radagast the Brown, one of Gandalf's fellow wizards? What's your opinion about him? We'll have Charlie first, then Crystal, and then Brenton.
Well, other than the fact that he's portrayed as a kind of poster child for the bird flu, I like Radagast. It seems like he's a character. Well, he is a character who appears briefly in The Lord of the Rings, and it seems like he's a character then that Peter Jackson looked at and said, man, I really wish we could have used him. Hey, let's stick him in The Hobbit. In fact, we use him a whole lot in The Hobbit, even though he's not really there. Again, when you raise the question of adaptation, probably the great disappointment of the Hobbit films as a whole is that when you compare them to the Lord of the Rings films, they are not a faithful adaptation. And though there are problems we can raise with the Lord of the Rings adaptations, I think they can be called, except by just absolute purists who really don't understand, in my mind, what adaptation is, I think they can be called faithful adaptations. But The Hobbit, I don't think, is necessarily faithful adaptation. Again, though, that doesn't necessarily make them automatically bad films. Though, as Brenton said in our last session, they have some wonders and some flaws, and I think that's a good way to think about them. All right, so Radagast is going to be in this series of movies, and in the end, I tend to think of them all as just one movie anyway. It's all just one story. So he's going to be in this series. Let's see what we can do with him. Let's have fun with him. The actor's terrific. I as silly as they were, I love the giant rabbits in the sleigh. And so once I decide that I'm going to sort of be okay with his presence, I tended to enjoy him as he appeared throughout the films.
I agree. He's very different. I think some people think he's homeless, and then he starts doing wizard things, and then people go, oh wait, it's Radagast. Oh wait, yeah. He was a lovable character, you know. And of course, yeah, like Charlie mentioned, again, he's not in the original text, of course. But you know, if you're going to insert a character, make them lovable, and that's what he did. And again, I like the rabbits too. I think, you know, I have some wild hares hanging out at my house, so I thought, well, if I could get a sleigh and some magical powers, it would be. I saved some gas, I guess, but no, there. It was an excellent. He was an excellent character. Lovable, dependable. And like you mentioned, the actor was fantastic. So,
yeah, I think actually Radagast grew up just a mile from where I grew up, and I think he sells vegetables at the farmer's market still today. I mean, doesn't he sort of grab a whole kind of segment of the world? And what I sort of like is that you guys are right that he doesn't fit into the Hobbit, but he fits into the War of the Ring. And he fits in as an unwitting helper, as he's pretty witless in this film as well. And though I don't know all the details of the Brown story, I think he's someone who gets lost in the thing that he was meant to do. And we see that possibility here in this story, where he's meant to guard over these wild growing things, but the wild growing things themselves could keep him from guarding over them. And I think that's actually a good little parable to have in the middle of the large cycle. I thought it was great. I thought probably fewer mushrooms and a little less pipeweed would have been helpful to him. But
less bird excrement, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. It was sort of a neat moment to see those rabbits run, I think. To me it was great. And then of course the kids loved it too. And kids are going to younger and younger to movies like these, and so to have these sort of moments in them, I think, is brilliant.
Well, I was just thinking that what Brenton said about playing to a larger segment, or a completely different segment, Radagast playing to a completely different segment. My thought was, yes, but it's the segment that doesn't go to watch movies.
Right. Yeah, maybe.
They're or doesn't tramp somewhere.
Or the segment that doesn't pay for them anyway. Yeah.
That's what I was about to say. The segment that downloads torrents.
Yeah, that's right.
On their 1987.
Yeah, with pizza boxes on the couch, right?
Well, you guys are having fun here, but let's move on to our next question. That is the last one concerning some, controversial things. There could be a lot of stuff that we could talk about, but we'll kind of conclude with this. But you guys can add any other components that maybe you thought that were definitely strayed too far. But how about the inclusion of Galadriel and Saruman? What do you think about them and why?
It's the same thing. Any chance I can get, and Crystal said this wonderfully well, and is definitely leading up to my own final opinion on the films. Any chance I can get to see Galadriel, whether she belongs there or not, I want to see her. Because just as a character, she's so utterly and completely wonderful. And Cate Blanchett does a great job in portraying her. So I want to see her whenever I can. And we know from the appendices and from the Quest of Erebor that the White Council was involved in chasing Sauron from Dol Guldur. So that was part of Tolkien's story. In terms of how Jackson portrayed it, we were talking a while ago while we were just sort of warming up and before we started recording, we were talking about just sort of the awkwardness in that third film of the battle that took place there between the White Council and Sauron and the Nine. I especially enjoyed their presence, Saruman and Galadriel, in the second film when the White Council was meeting at Elrond's home and in Rivendell. In the third film, I don't know. I'm back and forth. I don't know that I've come up with a conclusion. Maybe I just need to get used to it. But Crystal can maybe speak to this better than I can. Just the way her Galadriel's assault on Sauron was portrayed just seemed a bit awkward.
Yeah, I agree. Again, speaking of continuity of the Tolkien Legendarium, The Hobbit, and The Lord of the Rings, if you've read Silmarillion, Galadriel's there. Saruman's there. So they're sort of omnipresent in the Legendarium. So I think it was an excellent choice to include them in the films. But again, like I said, in the third film, you have this sort of bizarre, exchange, and then you don't see them anymore. They just sort of, they sort of vanish, and you have this almost epic back and forth between these, these magnificent sort of powers. But like you said, Charlie, it was so awkward. I really did sort of look around to see if, how much did I pay to go watch this? It was kind of odd. And Galadriel is such a magnificent character. Like you mentioned, I would love to see more of her. Very, very happy she was included, but I don't like the way she was included in this installment.
Yeah. I mean, so Galadriel, I agree. I mean, I struggle throughout the original films with the motivation of Saruman, and actually perhaps in the books as well. In the books, it has the echoing of myth, right? Saruman is lost. But in the films, we don't see that. The switch is great, and the deception that's meant to happen in the films means that we don't get to see his transformation of character. And so it's interesting here to see him in the council in the first film, I believe, when they go to Rivendell, and then later how he's fighting. So he looks like he's blocking, and we don't know why he's blocking the progress of things, but it looks like later he's still fighting on the side of light. And I think that's an interesting choice. I would have liked to see both characters developed more. And the terribleness, the terrifying nature of Galadriel, the power that exists that she keeps in play as one of the people of light is an intriguing thing, and I would have liked to see that developed a bit more further. As it was done, it was pretty awkward and elegant, not elegant at all. And yeah, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do with the way they wrapped up that storyline either. I think, yeah, sure. Add them, throw them in. That's great. They're there. They're in the story. They're in the background, and they fit as great actors on screen, great characters on screen, but it's not finished. And we'll see about that third, see what happens when we get the extended edition of the third film, whether or not there's more that's tied together. I don't know.
You know, Tolkien was often criticized for, I guess, the lack of females in his storyline.
Right.
And the thing is, Galadriel is a strong, powerful, benevolent female force. You know, I've written before on the female leadership roles in Lord of the Rings, and you know, she actually it actually says in the histories that she ruled democratically. So, you know, it was, she was a wonderful ruler, and she's a wonderful character, but really all we didn't get to see much at all of any of that. As we see in Lord of the Rings, like you mentioned, there's not much development, in the Hobbit films, as there were with Lord of the Rings. But then again, right, she's being added, you know, to these films. So, you know, they're trying to essentially insert a character that was not in the original story.
Mm. Yeah, that's going to have its limits, I think, just on the way that it played out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's I can see how difficult it would be to portray Galadriel at all in any kind of plot points in film, you know, because film is imagistic, film is pictures, film is action, it's picture in motion, and Galadriel is being and presence. It's her stillness. That's where her power is. Mm-hmm. And that is a very difficult thing to translate to the screen. How would you pull that off and make it interesting for the screen? And I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, I don't either.
But boy, her presence, that's Galadriel's power, just her being. Mm-hmm. And again, I thought that was pulled off very well in the second film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where she's the knowing person at the council. It's a nice moment. Is she and Gandalf and Mithrandel, are they meant to be in? Is there an intimacy that they're hinting at in that film, the second film?
I think maybe along the lines of that friendship idea that you were talking about in our last session.
Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
No romantic, strictly platonic, respectful.
Right, because you can't have an elf fall in love with a wizard, right?
Well, yeah, they already had one ridiculous relationship.
Yeah,
one ridiculous romantic entanglement. Two is.
It looks to me that in that second film, Gandalf looks to her for strength.
Yeah,
that just as the hobbits look up to Gandalf for support, he looks up to her, because in at least in terms of his incarnation in this world, she is immensely older than he is in the Legendarium. She's been around forever. Is she like a second generation elf from the beginning of time, second or third generation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, she was from the first age. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just an amazing character.
Wow.
Well, now that brings up the next question that actually was already planned, and that is, the average moviegoer isn't familiar with the Silmarillion, which actually only came out after Tolkien's death in the 70s. So what does it add knowing that material to your movie-going experience?
Well, for those who have not read The Hobbit, I don't think it's going to do much of anything. For those who have read The Hobbit and are thinking to themselves, where is all this extra stuff coming from? This isn't in the book. At least in some of the instances, the answer is it's in the overall Tolkien scheme. It's in his vast history, and that can provide some at least a little bit of comfort to those of us who love the book and have had a hard time seeing changes made to it.
I agree that, you know, the Silmarillion, for that, you know, for that, like you said, the average person, it would probably just be overlooked or seen as some, you know, minor detail. But again, as Jackson sort of being an enthusiast of Tolkien himself, I think it added layers of texture that were intended by Tolkien, that were sort of weaved into the tapestry of these movies. And I was tickled, honestly, to see some sort of undercurrent of the history and the legendarium planted in the films. Just happy, you know, ecstatic, because I think that's Jackson's way of sort of tipping his hat and saying, yeah, I did make a dwarf and an elf fall in love. However, we do have some, you know, some of the initial subtext that Tolkien intended in the film. So nicely done, too, I think.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's an intriguing question for me. I mean, I read all of it as a kid and then probably again as a teenager and then, but then set it aside. And so when the films came out a few years later, I mean, for me, it was a recovery of Tolkien. And so since that first Fellowship of the Ring movie came out, I've been slowly reading through the Legendarium and growing. And so it's actually harder for me to answer this question now, a decade later, than it was when I sort of began this journey. And so for me, I really dig it. I love all the extra stuff that's added, particularly when it's well done, when it's spliced in where you can hardly see it, when it adds energy to the story, all those things. When it's done well, I think it works really well. I think where this movie could have gone wrong, this series of movies could have gone wrong, is in two ways. One is that they essentially created a moving encyclopedia of Tolkien stuff. That would have been bad, I think. And they would have supported that, I think, in the second way. I mean, is by using sort of the way what they did with the Shakespeare films, how they use sort of these stage actors from sort of the upper British, the British crust of these super actors who have this tremendous ability to bring pathos to the stage and then do it on screen. Instead, they chose popular actors with popular faces who move like television actors. And so those two things together, I think are part of the genius of Peter Jackson. So when he does bring in these pretty obscure things from the Silmarillion or from Sauron Defeated or any part of the history of Middle Earth, that's never what people are complaining about.
We should probably mention that apparently, and I haven't checked this, but I you know, I've just seen it in a few places. Apparently, the only real resources for the extra Hobbit material are the appendices from the Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Because Tolkien sold the rights only to the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings and not the Silmarillion. And so technically, Jackson and his crew couldn't use the Silmarillion or any of those other texts as material for their movies. At least technically, that is supposed to be the case. And that's why then also, in talking about are there going to be more Middle Earth movies, the current answer seems to be no. Mm-hmm. Only the material in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Ring, including the appendices, is available to be used for filmmaking.
But I think we all know that he cheated on this. I mean, so it went to court, and Jackson's troupe won, but because everything is mentioned in the appendix, but the stories aren't in the appendix. The stories are in the appendices and the number of different appendixes. The stories are actually in these other books, and Peter Jackson is a Tolkien geek, and he knew these stories. And so what happens is when they bring in these more obscure things, none of the vocabulary, none of the writing comes in with it. Whereas in other parts of the films, we have these moments where one of the characters says something that comes out of The Lord of the Rings or out of The Hobbit. And then that phrase tends to have this sort of echoing character. That can't happen because of this limit. I'm actually glad that he cheated. I hope. I wouldn't mind he'd cheat again, actually. So.
Yeah, I mean, I still feel like, especially in the characterization, he did pull from from the histories. You know, he did pull from those things. Because even if you can't outright pull a story, you can still pull nuances of character from those stories. And I feel like, absolutely he cheated in that way. He created and molded those characters based on a larger legendarium than just The Lord of the Rings. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's sort of a funny moment. The three of us work as literary critics in some form or another, and so they had literary critics in the courtroom, professionals trying to divide the text to see what had actually happened there. It's not very often that we're called on for superhero legal powers or anything.
Dang it!
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
All right. Well, now let's start to wrap up with the final two questions here. Crystal, you haven't had the opportunity to see the extended ones for the first and second. Of course, the third at the time of recording has not happened because we're recording here less than a month since the final movie came out. So it'll just be Charlie and Brenton discussing the following question, and that is, does the extended Hobbit movies improve on the theatrical versions? Why or why not?
My answer for the first film is... it could go either way, yes and no. I so much want to see Tolkien's world that if I can have another 20 minutes of it, I'm happy to have it. One of the charming moments in the extended edition for the first film is another dwarf song, but this one's sung actually in Rivendell as a kind of response to the music of the elves. And it's humorous, it's charming, it's a little bit silly, but... it was nice to have that in there. It's in the second film, I guess, that I was more delighted with the extended edition. One of my complaints, and I think we voiced that in these sessions with the second film, is that its pace is so incredibly fast. There's just no time to stop and breathe. In the extended edition on the second film, there's a little bit more of that breathing pace, especially early on. I was especially delighted to see a version of the introduction to Beorn, which is completely absent from the theatrical edition of the second film, and they actually managed to work in a short version of it in the extended edition. Now we're talking about that moment where Gandalf introduces himself to Beorn along with his hobbit friend, and then he starts introducing the dwarves two by two in the book. Well, in the extended edition of the film, they have a version of that. It's awkward, it's truncated, yep. But at least it's there, and I was happy to see it.
Yeah, that was a real... I mean, Bjorn, on the ones we see on the screen, Bjorn almost disappears from The Hobbit, right? He hosts, and there's a brief discussion, and then he's about 7 seconds in the final battle scene, right? He's dropped from an eagle, and then eats things, and then he's gone, right? So that's it. I presume we'll have more in the extended version of the third one. But that was a nice... I'm glad that they did more with Bjorn, but it wasn't well done. I would like them to do extended version stuff that's more well done. What about... Now, maybe... I don't remember exact... Like, I didn't watch the normal... the theatrical version and the extended version side by side. Is Thorin's father, Thrain, is he in the theatrical version of the second film?
No.
So this is
Thrain or Thror? I confuse the names myself.
Thorin, son of Thrain, son of Thror? Yeah, so Thrain. So okay. Thrain the second, I guess he would be. I think Crystal probably has, she probably has the family tree tattooed on the inside of her wrist. But the, I don't think that Thror appears in the theatrical version of the second film.
No, it's in the extended edition.
Right, and so this creates sort of an interesting thing, because I watched the extended edition of the second film, then I went to the theater for the third film, and of course he's completely absent from that storyline. But it creates this new element of actually Thorin's father is alive, and this is a spoiler, I suppose, for those who haven't seen the extended edition. Thorin's father is alive, and the suspicions of Thorin have been true all along. So but I don't know if that actually adds much until we see the third extended edition. I don't know that we're actually getting anything more out of that, or if
I don't know, a little more presence of pathos in seeing the father's love for his son. But otherwise, yeah, yeah. I definitely see your question there, whether it's worth doing. But again, if it's, you know, I think there's like 25 extra minutes in the extended edition for the second film. So that's 25 more minutes I get to spend in Middle Earth.
Yeah.
Even if it's Peter Jackson's version of it.
Yeah, it's huge. That's for sure. Yeah. I don't remember the first much of the extended edition of the first film. I can't remember. It's been a couple of years, right, since I've seen it in theater. So they blend in my mind. But those were the things that struck out for me about the second extended edition.
All right, we'll have Crystal now join us for our last question here. And that is, overall, is the message found in The Hobbit, the book, versus the movie version the same or different? And then what is that message?
I don't know if the message is the same. The tone has certainly changed from an adventure tale, a journey tale, to an epic tale, and that much has changed. If the story is about how this tiny little humble hobbit can make a difference through humble means, perhaps some of that gets lost in the fact that Bilbo participates in the epic action, in the violent action. And that's something I think Tolkien would have been unhappy with. Overall, the real question for me became a question of why I still want to keep watching these films. And so it was very much about the experience, the aesthetic experience of the text. I've already talked about adaptation, and if I think to myself, well, I don't feel like these movies are good adaptations, I then ask the question, so do I think they're good films? In the case of the second film especially, I thought it rather flawed, again, by excessive pace, and I almost feel that way about the third movie, but I want to reserve some of my judgment for the extended edition. And so I said to myself, yeah, but Charlie, you're still fascinated by these movies. If you don't think they're good adaptations, and if you aren't all that convinced that they're particularly good films, at least in the instance of the second one, what is it? What is it that makes you want to go back to that world? And Crystal has already said it, but I can connect it to my last reading of The Lord of the Rings, and The Hobbit, which was a couple of years ago, just a couple of years ago, in preparation for a class. And what I noticed in The Lord of the Rings especially is just how much time, even to the point of excess, it seems, for many people, Tolkien spends on his geography, on painting his world, on creating that entire world. And that, in my mind, is part of the magic of the book and the magic that Peter Jackson captures perfectly. And again, Crystal's already said this. What Peter Jackson does well, if he does other things wrong, is he's an image smith. And he is able to capture Tolkien's geography, his world, his sub-created world, as Tolkien referred to it. And I am fascinated by that world. I love that world. I enjoy it. I want to spend time in that world because it's Tolkien's world. If the characters aren't doing what they're supposed to do or acting the way they're supposed to act, if the plots aren't Tolkien's, at least Jackson has captured his world, and it's such a rich and wonderful world that I'm willing to compromise a whole lot so that I can spend time there.
Yeah, very well said. I think I wrote this, I wrote a blog about this. Britton and I actually participated in the Battle of the Five Blogs, which was actually six blogs.
Yeah. I think same as the film. Who knows how many armies were in that film.
Yeah, we're not really sure. but, you know, I mentioned, and we all sort of brought up some really fascinating points about the third film. But, you know, the book talks specifically, and I think Lord of the Rings, too, all boils down to greed. It's about a ring, about possessing the ring or destroying the ring. And in The Hobbit, it's gold. I need to get my mountain back. So I, you know, have my fortune back. And of course for Thorin, it corrupts him just like it is supposed to eventually. So one of the themes that really jumped out at me, of course, has been a constant theme in Tolkien, the books and the films, is greed, and how that desire, that avarice, can change a person, can alter their personality, alter their responses to other people, alter their behavior. In the films, I thought this was really ironic. I believe that the choice to extend it to three films was a choice by a bunch of greedy film, some film folks who wanted to, you know, milk that cow, you know, as long as they could. I mean, that's why we have three films. Now, like Charlie, I love it, and I will go back every time, and I'll buy the movies, and I'll watch the movies at home because I love that world. And it's so much better than ours. no taxes. No calories, I guess. Yeah. No, but it's a beautiful world. But I just thought that was highly ironic that all of these films sort of center around the theme of greed, and how the fact that the stretching out of this one book into three films, which I think sort of ended up being a lot of hand-to-hand combat more than anything. Even in the final one, I think there was just, it's overdosed. the conflict and the action sequences were very long, very arduous. And they did that because they didn't have enough, you know, story. We were stretching it out as long as they could. And so ultimately the whole point that we have three films is because they wanted to make money off of these three films. So as much as I love Tolkien and I love his world, and I'll pay, like I said, I'll pay the $12 over and over again. You know, I love being in his world. I love being enraptured in Middle Earth. I think the financial or the fiscal goal was to make money. It's a business. So I just found that highly ironic.
Well, there you go. I mean, I don't know how to answer that question, I guess. But I don't want to leave your actual point, but I wonder if once they realized they had too much for one film, if there was the draw, the synchronicity of having a second trilogy was as luring as, you know, money or whatever, right? So, because I don't know that the third film's done spectacularly well in theaters. Like, it'll do well overall, but I think it was a slow, it wasn't nearly as successful as the others. And certainly not as successful as how the Return of the King finished up. But I mean, your point's really intriguing. I mean, both the Hobbit films and the Lord of the Rings films capture pretty well what I think Tolkien has done, is given us parables of greed, but also parables of addiction. I mean, wasn't Thorin maddening in The Hobbit when you read the book? And he's maddening in the film. Like, he's not just gone mad, but he's maddening to the reader. You know, why, you know, you just want to take him and to shake him. Of course, he's a dwarf and he'd cut my hands off, but you want him to recover, right? And you just want to jolt him out of his world. And I felt that both in reading and in watching. And so I thought there was continuity there. And I don't know what Tolkien's real struggles were, but I don't think that unless he actually tried to give up, you know, poached eggs on toast or smoking his pipe, I don't know that addiction was really one of his problems. And and so for him to come up with, I think, what is a really psychologically complex and authentic conversation about addiction was pretty cool. Anyway, I saw K. connections there. Both films have good warnings about power as well, and how power works and what power does. And also, I think, based on Crystal's points of how these are businesses, I think there's good questions that should reverberate in the halls of Hollywood as well, or New Zealand or whatever. But I mean, so I thought they did pretty well. But the reality is Peter Jackson loves Tolkien's world, and he's a Tolkien geek, but he doesn't understand Tolkien's worldview. And one example I would give is the idea of providence, which is behind all of Tolkien's works, is this unseeing moving hand of a provider that sits behind the world, unnamed typically, called luck in The Hobbit. If you follow the thread of luck throughout that little book, I think there's some of that gets recovered in this film, but I don't know. I don't think he knows what to do with Tolkien's worldview, and so we lose something of the depth of the myth. Tolkien had his roots going into deeper soil and better watered soil than I think Peter Jackson has, and so we see that the films are a bit anemic when it comes to the mythic grandeur. Sure, he's got visual grandeur, but when it comes to human storied lives, I think it's less compelling, and I think it's just because he's less deeply rooted than Tolkien was. So, does that make any sense?
Yeah, you're saying an answer to the question that William started us with. is the message there that some of the message does seem to get lost, especially that message of providence? It's just not there in the Hobbit films as strongly as it is in the books. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And I think it's because the foundation's not there. I don't think he skips it. He just doesn't know it exists, really.
Do you think that's I guess more of a side effect of Hollywood sort of trying to eschew the mystical? Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like the film that just recently came out, there's been a lot of controversy in the Christian journalism world because his conversion experience was played down in that film. Right. And it was so there seems to be not a negligence, but a hesitation about including anything mystical, religious, spiritual, deeply spiritual in something that would be, I guess, considered, for the most part, a secular film.
That hesitation may be there in part because of the content, but it also may be because of the writers and the directors who themselves, just as Brenton was saying about Jackson, don't really understand it and therefore don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not. I don't think it's intended. Like, yeah, I suppose a spiritual but not religious version of The Lord of the Rings might be the best they could do if they tried. But, you know, they just, I think, and if I can speak as a non-American here, the American media presumes it knows something about people that are committed in faith journeys. And I think largely we can see by the American media that they don't understand this. And I would say this is for the people defending it or critical of it in general, whatever that faith may be. And yeah, conversion stories are tough to do on screen. In general, I mean, they've been the Billy Graham film series, I think, has sort of bent that, or the Left Behind series has bent that for us. And I think it'll be a long time before that recovers. And so I that's why I think that we would struggle to see, you know, a Marilyn Robinson or a David Foster Wallace book make it to film in a way that sort of captures that that transformational experience that comes out of the soul. I just don't think that we have the kind of filmmakers who have the ability to do that. And Charlie talked about how you go to image with those things, but also I just don't think they would understand it. It doesn't make sense. So if Marilyn Robinson makes it to film, it'll be a good white trash film, right? A story of redemption, or whatever, right? But it'll be maybe even a biblical retelling, of Ruth or whatever, but it won't have sort of the depth that she has. And I don't think it's neglect. I think it's just sheer something that they, it's like a melody that they just haven't learned to hear yet. And that's okay.
The, that sounds very, I was about to say that lines up with what Lewis says about looking at versus looking along.
Yeah.
These people are looking at and trying to capture the essence of looking along. And they just can't because they haven't experienced it.
Yeah.
Well, there are a few bright points in terms of Christian themed films or Christians making films, but they are few and far between yet. But there are some bright points every so often, just in the last decade, even that makes the meme a little more hopeful.
Yeah, and it could be that the further we get away from an actual understanding, so if somebody were to cover Judaism or Christianity on film now, they actually have to do research in the same way they would have to do it when they did the Gandhi film, right, with his Hinduism. So maybe that distance will actually give space for this sort of thing. But we would hate for actually the left behind kind of approach to have taken the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit. I think that would have bent it to make it a Sunday school lesson.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah, and so that would have bent it in a worse way. In the case of Peter Jackson, we have a good storyteller and a great did you call him a screensmith or an image smith? Image smith. I'm going to use screensmith since we're making up words. He's a painter, right? And so in this case, I would take that over the other side if we're talking about extremes.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Great discussion that we're having here. I'm going to need to wrap us up. I'm sure there could be more that we could say in regards to that question or the topic overall, but we're going to have to end our discussion. I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator and producer of All About Jack. Thanks for joining us. Before ending, let me thank each of our guests for being here. Charlie, thanks again for joining us for this podcast.
Thank you, William. I had a blast.
All right, and let me just go ahead and have you, Charlie, and we'll have everyone also share a little bit about themselves and some things that they have online. You've got actually an article that, when we release this part of the episode here, an article is just coming out. First, tell us about your online presence briefly, and then about where they can find this new article.
Oh, I have a Facebook account, of course, and some of my books are featured on Facebook or various places. And I have a website, charliewstar.com. The article in reference will come out in Lookout Magazine and on January 25th. And I write a monthly column for the Lookout on Christianity and culture, mostly on arts and media. And then I've got, as you mentioned, a couple of books out recently. And our C.S. Lewis fans will be happy to hear that in Seven, the journal that comes out of the Waite Center at Wheaton College, I've just been privileged to publish two brand new C.S. Lewis pieces. Well, not brand new in the sense that he just wrote them. That would have been quite a trick. But new in the sense that they've never been published before. There's a complete essay that is Lewis's critique of Lenin's communism called On Bolshevism, which I think Lewis wrote in 1928 or so. That's being released for the first time. And then there are a couple of fragments on myth that I've dubbed mythonomy, that have never been seen before, and those are out now, available in volume 31 of the journal 7.
All right, we'll have links in the show notes for how people can for where people can go to get copies of those things. Let me now thank Crystal Hurt for being with us, and so thanks, Crystal.
Well, thank you for having me, William. It's always a pleasure.
Now, you have that devotional book that just came out, as well as your online presence. Tell us a little bit about each.
I have an online presence at crystalhurd.com, C-R-Y-S-T-A-L-H-U-R-D. Supposedly, my husband's ancestors were sheep herders, but we used the U at some point. And on there, I usually post just about Lewis life, leadership, you know, Christianity, culture, things of that nature. So I usually post there. I also blog at All Nine Muses and Legendarium, which is a sci-fi fantasy site. In addition to that, as you've mentioned, I do have a new devotional out. It is a woman's devotional, but men can read it. I fully welcome you, if you're male, to read it. But it's called 30 Days of C.S. Lewis, a women's devotional, and basically pulled quotes from Lewis texts and speak spiritually about sort of our struggles and other things we sort of encounter in our daily lives and how those quotes sort of lend us some assistance and insight into those. As well, I actually have a chapter coming out in the summer in a book on C.S. Lewis and women that was commissioned by the C.S. Lewis Foundation. So we'll give you some more information about that here in the coming months as we get closer to publication.
All right. And, of course, Britton, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, I'd love to be here.
And, Britton, tell us more about your website, Pilgrim in Narnia, and any other things that you might have happening.
Sure. Well, I write lots of cool books like the other two do. I just don't tell anybody about them. So I'm a little earlier in that process. Most of my work that you would see would be on apilgriminnarnia.com. And it's a fairly expansive site that talks about, I guess, faith, fantasy, and fiction, covering C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien and the way they explore ideas about the world. A lot of them are faith-related. And that includes, it was where we began the Battle of Five Logs in honor of the Battle of Five Armies film that came out in mid-December there. And Crystal's one of those bloggers. And there's a few there, including the Tolkienist, and there was a Canadian blogger who did argue that Peter Jackson should have filmed the movies in the north rather than in the south, I guess, the extreme south, and has some pictures and some pretty cool things there. And I also do some academic work. One of the things that I'm working on is a preface to the Screwtape Letters that is different than the one that we have printed in the books that we own of C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters. And that preface adds that book to some other books that C.S. Lewis was working on, these space books, his science fiction work, which is kind of, that's a lot of fun. And again, just as we've been talking about Tolkien geeks, C.S. Lewis geeks like that sort of thing, right? I think actually Charlie wrote a thesis on those books. Is that right? The space trilogy?
I wrote a dissertation on Lewis's epistemology that began with with one sentence in Paralandra, and it ended up 350 pages.
There you go. There you go. I've been asked to keep mine shorter, but that's it.
Yeah, talk about elaborating on something here.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, I'm on Twitter at Brenton Dana, Brenton Dana, Daana, as well as on Facebook. And I think if you go to any one of our Facebook accounts, you'll end up finding the other through our writings. Yeah.
And I'll, of course, have links in the show notes for that as well, which, of course, if you're listening to the audio, either you got it from a friend or something, or you downloaded it and then maybe forget where you got it from, you can go to either EssentialCSLewis.com. That's where I centralize everything. More specifically, the podcast is at allaboutjack.podbean.com. So the links that we've been mentioning here, you can find that in the show notes. If it's been some time since the podcast was released, you need to maybe look for the Hobbit movies, and you can find it from that. Also at those locations, then, you can find more information about Lewis at EssentialCSLewis.com specifically. There's a variety of resources. Something regular that you can count on is a daily fact, quote, and quiz question on Lewis. Then regarding the podcast, I've spoken with a variety of people over the last several years, including Douglas Gresham, who is C.S. Lewis's stepson. Also, Dr. Michael Ward, Dr. Bruce Edwards, Dr. Devin Brown, and many others, just to name some of those. So be sure to stop by there. Release shows about every week. That's not always new, but I think last year I had 30-something new episodes, so a lot of things to check out. So thanks again, and be sure to join us again for All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast.